Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, the Adam Schefter Podcast. It's one of the top NFL podcasts for a reason. Top executives, coaches, players, and the best analysts in the game. Be sure to check it out. You can follow the Adam Schefter Podcast now, as well as The Right Time, wherever you get your podcast. Also, relive one of the greatest icons and most successful teams in sports history, Michael Jordan and the 97-98 Chicago Bulls. Stream the Emmy and NAACP Image Award-winning series, The Last Dance, on ESPN+. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe. You are a hater. It is that time of week where you have a guest join us, coming to us live. You check him out at Slate.com. The new season of Slow Burn going to be coming around. You want to check that out with him. He also insists upon making sure that we understand that he was the fastest 10-year-old in America at some point. Joel Anderson, what's going on, man?
Yeah, man, this is about 16, 20 years after what would have been my Olympic peak if I'd kept on that same trajectory. You know what I'm saying?
That's all I was just wondering. Like, if you watch the Olympics and you'd be out here looking at it and you're like, that was supposed to be me.
Actually, like, definitely in 96, I was like, man, if I kept on the right path, I've been doing, you know, I've been doing my little sprint thing. And then 2000, I was like, this would really been my peak. You know what I'm saying? It would have been me right out there. But yeah, you know, I mean, the thing is like, my body wasn't built to be a sprinter. You know what I'm saying?
That's what it was.
God had other plans for me.
How much did your wife ridicule you about this?
Well, you know what? She had a huge poster. I don't know if you've ever seen it before. There's a huge poster that we had on the wall in our dining room of me in my starting stance when I was 11 years old.
Oh, she got that for you.
Oh, yeah. I think we're proud of my accomplishments in this family. You know what I'm saying?
No, that is a woman who loves you more than you deserve. Like, I hear that right there, and I'm like, that woman loves you more than you deserve.
That's probably true, but I mean, we still are proud of my accomplishments. We don't even get to that year that I won the Spelling Bee, led my football team to a 10-0 record. You know what I'm saying? We don't have to get into all of that. This isn't about my athletic career.
I need to have you and Michael Felder all here at one time talking about how excellent you guys were when you were 11 years old. Like, I'm glad you guys went and accomplished something else, because otherwise y'all be selling shoes in the mall. I hear on this 4 touchdowns. Season, one game.
Well, as I always say, if anybody else had ever scored 4 touchdowns in a game before, they would talk about it, too.
Man, yo, we want to talk about, like, Texas and all the madness that we kind of got in college football right now. But, yo, I want to be clear that I'm not trivializing anything that anybody's going through right now. But the Olympics have kind of been a bummer in this first week. Everything we talk about is kind of sad.
Man, even if you just separated yesterday from the Olympic experience, it wasn't even a great one before that. I mean, the American men have lost in basketball. The American softball team has lost. Katie Ledecky finished second. Nobody has seen that before. So, I mean, like, and that's before you get to the reason that NBC wants to do this entire enterprise. They want to feature Simone Biles to the rest of the world, and that's gone. And I mean, what else is there? Like, for people that are sort of casual fans of the Olympics and the American team, like, what else is there to really be excited about?
And by the way, that's all of America, right? Like, the Olympics are for casual fans. That's the whole point of the endeavor, really, is something that casual fans can get into. Now, I will say this about Simone Biles. Like, I don't know if you watched the first night. Well, I mean, what was night to us when they put it on television? She wasn't on that first night. Like, that first night, she couldn't stick a landing for anything. Apparently, at the trials, she couldn't do it. She just so much better than everybody else that, like, even with these giant mistakes that she was making, she's still beating everybody, because what she does and tries is just so absurdly difficult. And so when she ultimately decided to back away, I was like, it kind of adds up based on what I had seen the night before. I don't really require no explanation. Like, one thing I feel pretty confident about, if you ain't lost in 8 years and you took the time at this age where most people walk away from this to go over there to Tokyo and still compete in this, and knowing that she's there on some, y'all ain't about to forget about me, right? Like, this ain't just about athletics for her. This is about what happened with Nasser and everything else. If she say she couldn't do it, then she just couldn't do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think about this. I once interviewed Eitan Thomas about Michael Jordan for when he was with the Wizards. And one day he's just in the locker room and Michael Jordan is getting his knee drained. And, you know, this is 2002, 2003. And he asked Michael Jordan, hey, why are you still doing this? And that's kind of what I was, I mean, that we got anything else at all from Simone Biles? Because this is even like a real Olympics. Like, it doesn't even feel like the same thing. It's off of the normal Olympic year cycle. So the fact that, like, she was even willing to want to put that record of dominance up to the, you know what I'm saying? Like, to put that at risk, like, I'm sort of like, you know, we kind of got what we got. Like, we, everything that we needed to know about Simone Biles, we already knew. Like, she's already probably the best gymnast most of us have seen in our lifetime. Nothing that happened in Tokyo was going to change that. So that she wants to protect herself and, like, didn't feel right, who are we to say that she should have kept on going, right?
Yeah, and I'm not going to lie. I did have a little measure of judgment for the fact that she was participating in this until I understood the Nassar component, right? Yeah. And for people who don't realize, she is a survivor of the abuse of Larry Nassar, the USA Gymnastics team doctor, who I don't even know what the numbers are. The number doesn't even matter, right? Like, the number of how many people he abused is like, so what's the temperature of the sun?
Right, right.
The number does not matter. It's hot, right, dog. It's really, really hot. And so... Right. She took that weight for a whole lot of people and decided to come out here, and then she could not do it. And that, you can make the argument, did she quit? Maybe, but let me tell you this, and this is something I didn't fully do the math on. Man, you mess up in one of them gymnastics moves, you mess around and break your neck, dog. Like, there are things involved with gymnastics that I really think we undersell the danger of, like the balance beam. The thing is 4 feet off the ground, it's 4 inches wide. I'm looking at these small women on that balance beam, and their feet are the width of the balance beam. You realize how easy a mistake could just ruin everything for you? And for dudes, you can imagine, you dude out there, miss with 1 foot, what gonna hit the beam? That's right. Right. You gonna hit the beam. You know what I'm saying?
Looking like a blooper reel. Yeah.
Yeah, your essence. You're gonna be looking like a blooper reel, and then you're gonna look like sex sent me to the ER when it gets to the hospital. Like, nah, actually, I was doing gymnastics. Yeah, buddy. Gymnastics. That's what you were doing. Okay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing is that, so I saw her coming into the trials. Actually, you know, you talked about like everything that led up to this, and in the trials, it didn't feel the same. And like, this is maybe, you know, I hate to just say that I was out ahead of this or whatever, but I remember me and my wife, we were talking about it during the trials, because she follows gymnastics. It doesn't seem right. Like, it seems, something seems off. She also didn't seem very happy. There was nothing very joyful about it. And so it makes sense that we ended up here. But yeah, for those of us that do not follow gymnastics, and that's probably most of us, because most of us only look every four years, she said this term twisties, that she got the twisties while competing the other day, which is essentially like, I guess it's, for lack of a better term, the yips. It's more than mental, because it affects like what will happen to you physically. But, you know, losing your place in air as a gymnast is extremely dangerous. And so it's not just a matter of her quitting, it's a matter of her protecting herself. And she also helped America preserve its silver medal, because if she had done poorly again and, you know, landed poorly on her vault or scored really bad again, they might have gotten a bronze or something like that. So there's a lot of elements to all of this, but I think it goes a lot more beyond she just quit. And for people that think that she just quit, I imagine, you know, take your ass out there and go flip around and see how you feel about it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, where I think this also gets partially awkward is, as I always say about the Olympics is sports for people who aren't sports fans. So yes, the people who are invested in Simone Biles are far less likely to be invested in some of these ideas that we have about sports and quitting and everything else. Because look, quitting is a thing. I do argue that quitting, a wee bit overrated. Underrated, excuse me. I think quitting has some value that people don't really give it enough credit for at different times. Some know when to walk away, know when to run, right? Like, sometimes.
Yeah, Vontae Davis, you know what I'm saying? Like, hey, man, yeah. I have it today. You know, I don't think I need to be back out there.
Yeah, like, sometimes it's got to be that. But there are some people, like, if you just quitting because you're getting your ass handed to you, then yeah, I'm going to judge you. I really don't have any problem doing it. If you just quitting because you're losing, I do feel like in a lot of ways, you just got to take this L all the way out, right? So Naomi Osaka, who after she lost in the third round at the Olympics, said that she just didn't have it. And that's a crazy level of pressure that she's dealing with. If she had bailed in the middle of the match, just talking about, I didn't have it. No, not trying to hear it. Not trying to hear it.
Yeah.
With Biles, because of the actual danger that is involved in continuing, if you don't have it, that's a different story. Like, I saw something on Twitter where a gymnast said that a lesser athlete probably would have blown her knee in the air, not doing the number of twists that was originally the plan once she had gotten into the sky.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't even know that. I hadn't heard that bit of it. Yeah.
Like, I think, man, they high up off the ground doing all this madness, man.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's just not comparable to anything else. Like, even, you remember Oliver McCall?
Yes.
The boxer who, like, quit in the middle of the ring?
Yes.
I can't remember. Was he fighting Lennox Lewis?
No, because Lennox beat him in the rematch. I forget who he was fighting against, but I know exactly who you're talking about.
It was a boxer. This is in the 90s. He was, he was briefly a heavyweight champion in the 90s, and he quit in the ring. But, like, not quit. He, like, basically had a breakdown and would not protect himself, and he just let this dude hit him, and everybody was like, man, what happened? Why would he quit like that? But man, it's really hard for us to understand, especially in these individual sports, because even though Simone is competing for a team, she's ultimately out there by herself. When it's all on you and you've got to protect yourself and you know that you can't do it anymore, you can't just like sub in somebody else,
Right.
And so sometimes it might just be like that. You just, you know what? My mind will not allow my body to go one step further. And it's like, sometimes we just have to accept that. Now, if you were the fan of the Colts on the day Devontae Davis decided not to show back up, you know what I'm saying? Maybe you're upset. You're like, man, we got our fourth corner out there. That's a problem. But to be honest, I mean, it just had nothing to do with us, man. And if they're out there protecting themselves, it's just better in the long run. Because if Simone Biles got hurt, like severely hurt, the only thing we could say is, oh, man, that's too bad. She's protecting her long term future. And it's really hard to say more about it other than that. Than just like, hey, look, man, sometimes people don't have it. And she had to protect herself. And we might never know exactly the reasons why she didn't have it here for the Tokyo Games, but it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah, by the way, you were right and I was wrong. That was in the second fight against Lennox Lewis that what? Oliver McCall had that break. It must have been a break, because the last thing I'm doing against Lennox Lewis, who I just beat before with a lucky punch, is putting my hands down.
Can you imagine like what it takes to just put your hands down and Lennox Lewis tee off on you, bro? I mean,
no,
something's going on. Yeah, something's really going on. Yeah.
I think I told you about this, but since I'd been here and before the world shut down, I got to go to some boxing matches with some pretty good seats. ESPN's got the contract. My good friend Corey Erdman working with DAZN so he could get me in there for some of them fights.
Oh, shout out Morning Jones. I forgot, remember that.
Yeah, man. Let me tell you what we underestimate greatly: the jab. Like, we watch the jab on television. Like, the jab is like a version of the running layup, right? Like, if you try to hit a, like, run full speed down the court and then hit a layup, a lot harder than it looks on television. Dog, yeah. I was watching them dudes take them jabs to the face. I was like, oh my God, you just take like 8, 10, 12 of those?
But have you ever sparred before?
No.
Okay, so I got to boxing briefly, like, maybe 15 years ago. The security guard at my office convinced me to do it. He's like, man, you got to come on and do this, nice little workout. So anyway, I do the boxing workouts for, 3 months, getting into shape. And, of course, when you get to the gym, they can't wait to make you fight. They want you to fight somebody. So they put me in there with the security guard, And I'm just like, this is the first time that I've ever sparred against anybody. And I'm getting hit with these jabs. And I'm like, man, I can't even see them. You know what I'm saying? I can't even see where these punches are coming from. And I'm like, why would anybody do this? Fighting is so much harder than you would ever think. I know there's some people out there that probably listen to this that have done sparring before. But for people that have ever been in sparring, like, it is extremely hard. Like, one of the sports that is most underrated for its difficulty, after I went through that experience, was boxing.
Oh, we boxing is hard as hell. Let me tell you something. I ain't need to get out there and get no ring to understand boxing. The difficulty of boxing. I was at Caesar's Palace in 2002. And they had some boxing arcade game, right?
Oh, man.
And they gave you the paddles and you did the boxing. And I just remember that the second opponent was basically Dennis Rodman. Like, it was some guy that was Dennis Rodman's face on it. Dog, that was the most physically demanding thing yes. I've ever done. I can't imagine 3 rounds of actual yes. real live boxing. And that,
yes.
and this is without me getting hit in the face or like having an actual threat of somebody hitting me. This is just me playing against a screen.
But Monty, look, the thing that they do to get you in boxing training is like they get you a heavy bag and they're like, all right, punch as hard as you can for a minute. And because people don't know how hard punching is and how much energy you expend while punching, people burn themselves out. Like 15 seconds of consecutive punching is extremely physically draining. Like you yes. have no idea until you actually do it. So then imagine throw in the bag is going to hit me back. You know what I'm saying? Now imagine that. That's how hard boxing is. And I'm telling you, man, people don't understand. Actually, about the Simone Biles is everything is it. We just don't understand what elite athletes go through. We actually don't understand how difficult it really is. And so we sit at home and we watch and we only take into account the performance and not everything that goes into it. And so we can't understand how somebody might do gymnastics and like lose place of themselves because we just get so used to them doing it. But trust me, man. Like, nobody that works that hard to do what they do would just walk away on a lark.
Right. Well, I also feel like on that, for those of the people who are critical of Simone Biles, this ain't really got, as you say, it's really ain't got nothing to do with you. There ain't that much to say. I would also make the argument for some of the people who are her most fervent defenders. This ain't really got nothing to do with you. This ain't got to do with your job. You know, right. This is a pretty singular case. Every story that comes out in these things winds up being about the person that's talking about it. Right. And sometimes it's not about you. There is one Simone Biles. If you're going to acknowledge there's one Simone Biles, then acknowledge the singularity of the situation that she is in. Because when I add all the things, hey, we all carry some measure of weight, and I don't want to pretend like there ain't people at their jobs that are carrying weight or whatever it is, and they have their own difficulties who can relate to a degree to what they see. I'm not saying that ain't the case. I'm just saying, are you at work so that you can carry the weight for the survivors of Larry Nassar in front of the world? Because I feel like that's a lot heavier weight than what we're talking about here. You got the whole world watching you at every turn. And as much as you and I are like, she's the greatest of all time, nothing that happens here matters. She ain't lost in 8 years in some things coming up to this point, right? Is that your life? Because I know damn well that ain't my life. I done lost a lot in the last 8 years. You know, I don't have to worry about people looking like, man, they might think I'm sorry now if I lose. No. I ain't really got that. It ain't there. Like, her life, her situation, it's not ours. And we don't have to personalize every single thing that we see come up.
Right. Bomani, as much as I think of myself, and I'm sure as much as you think of yourself, I am not so confident enough that I'm going to analogize myself to Simone Biles. You know what I mean? Like, I just like, you know, I think the world of myself. You know, people that know me know, like, you know, I feel pretty good about who I am and what I've done in this world and what I can do. Nah, bro, I cannot say that I can relate to anything that Simone Biles is going through. Like, maybe elements of the journey, but no, I'm not Simone Biles, and it doesn't do me much good to try to pretend that I can understand what she's going through and who she is.
This is not a very modest pairing that you have here on this program, right? Right? We good with each other. We good with ourselves. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's mutual admiration and it's solo admiration. Like, this is where we stand as a collective. We ain't that, man.
Nah. I was like, you know what? She got it. What they say, she a different breed. You know what I'm saying? That's not us. And again, we dope. You know what I'm saying? And we know we dope. We not afraid to tell people we dope. But I would not sit up here and be like, you know, I'm doing this for anybody else and anybody can take something else from my journey, because I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
You know, again, like, Simone Biles is something totally all different. It goes the same thing with anybody else, man. Like, I'm, you know, Naomi Osaka, none of these folks, we don't really know who they are and we don't know what they go through. And I'm not, you know, silly enough to think that I have any understanding of like their lives and that anybody could learn, you know, that I could draw any parallel between my life and theirs.
Right. And at these bizarro Olympics, the one thing I do think that we can relate to is the idea that you out there for dolo, man. Right. Yeah. Like, she out there with all these youngsters who I'm sure she, you know, she's like mother hen over there to most of them. But that ain't squad. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that ain't the homies. Those ain't the people that she done come up with the whole way. She out there for self. Your family at the crib watching this stuff at 3 o'clock in the morning. I bet you try to talk to them on the phone and it'd be on the delay, you know? Yeah. Like, for all the people who are there at the Olympics, if you don't win gold, man, I bet you'd be regretting the hell out of everything that you did. I put in 5 years and this the Olympics I got.
Oh, dog, you can't even get it in the Olympic Village. To me, that would be the fun, like the buzz, you know what I'm saying? Yes. Tokyo, meet somebody from Mali or something. You know what I'm saying? You never know what that experience was supposed to be like, and then they're just stuck. I don't know about you. I follow some Olympians on Instagram or whatever and Twitter, and I'm just getting a lot of, you know, pictures from their hotel room.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you go over there, underperform, and then you got to go back to your room, and you done been through all this protocol and training and everything else. That has to be a really lonely, frustrating feeling.
Yeah, I tell you the other thing, too, about the Olympics. I've been watching a little bit of it. Watched some of that water polo. I watched some of that triathlon, the men's and women. And I'm like, there's a lot of work y'all going through to not make no money, dog. Like, whoa. I'm looking at how hard that stuff is. Like, I was talking to a friend of mine who was like, I don't think people understand how hard water polo is. I'm like, that's only because they not watching. I don't know how you could think it was anything else. Like, once I realized as I got older that they wasn't standing in the bottom of the pool, I was like, oh my God, it's the hardest thing in the world.
Well, look, man, last night I was watching, I guess it was the diving finals afternoon. And so they interviewing them, they standing on the medal stand. And I just remember thinking, I was like, all right, now what? You know what I'm saying? Like, okay, like, are you going to get, I mean, I know that like being great is great for its own means. Like that's, you go down in the record books as, you know, a gold medalist in diving. But now what? Like, what am I going to do with this? It just seems like for all that effort, all that work, and at the end of the day, you just like, yeah, man, I don't even think people going to recognize you on the street if you were a diving gold medalist. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just kind of, do you think you can get like a restaurant reservation because you got a gold medal in diving or whatever? I mean, maybe I don't know all the benefits to that, but yeah, man, it just seems like a lot of work for not very much payoff unless you happen to be somebody like Simone Biles or, you know.
And think about how that L feels, right? Like, ooh, you know, most of you guys know this. I had a television show and it got canceled. And that television show was a goal. Like, I don't do a lot of goal setting, right? But that television was a goal. That was what, you know, I wanted to get to. It was a place I wanted to reach. It didn't really work out. And then one day they tell you the show's canceled, right? And so, you know, the show's probably going to get canceled. Like, very few people have ever been blindsided by a cancellation. Like, it wasn't something that I didn't see coming. It wasn't something that I didn't understand. But I was talking to a friend of mine in the industry about it who was like, there's a psychological thing to having your show canceled that's kind of hard to explain to people. And like, yeah, you know me, I roll with it. Like, I understood what it was, but I can't pretend like it wasn't a little bit of a sting that came along with that. Now imagine like you finish butt naked last in your heat at the your first heat at the Olympics. You are the TV show. Your TV show just got canceled. Like, I was watching the triathlon and watching these people get lapped, and you can't quit. Like, that's right there, bro. Where I'm like, if you quit, I don't judge you, but I do judge you. But I know they be wanting to quit at the back end of that. You just got out the water and you in dead ass last. You sopping wet. Now you about to run or jump on a bike. That's the next one.
Yeah, the for who for what games. It's just like, man, I mean, I could keep doing this and it's hot out here and I could throw up at the end. Or, you know what? I proved that thing I needed to prove. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I didn't have it today. Yeah.
If I'm all the way at the back, yeah. I mean, y'all don't know my hamstring. You know what I'm saying? like I might have to take a couple gimp steps. Like I'm not, you ain't gonna convince me that somebody couldn't get like a little benefit of like, yo, let me just get 10 seconds.
But you
all
know
right,
what?
Cool. Now I'm gonna get back.
Nah, you do that, man, because look, man, I once, I fumbled in my high school's rivalry game. I fumbled, dude.
Y'all had a rival?
Up. Come on, man.
Don't ain't that many Saint, private schools in Houston.
You ain't heard of St. Thomas, man? That was,
oh,
that's
okay,
the,
I
the
had
oldest.
Heard of St. Thomas. Yeah, yeah, okay.
It's the old, you know, one of the oldest Catholic, you know, school rivalries in Houston, right? And so I fumbled in the game, although I was down. If you review the tape, I was down, okay? But anyway, they call the fumble. The safety picks it up, runs it in for a touchdown. We lost the game 14-7, okay? But after I fumbled, I laid down on the ground like I was hurt. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was just like, ah. And I just remember looking at it on film. I was like, boy, that little weak dog. I was like, I wish I could have had that moment back because that looked embarrassing as hell. And I was just like, I don't know, man. Sometimes when you fake that injury, it makes it look worse sometimes too. You know what I'm saying?
That's fair. By the way, did y'all have seats on both sides of the stadium or just one side?
We had stands on both sides.
So. Okay, no. Because remember I told you that my school had played straight my senior year? It was St. Thomas. It was St. Thomas. St. Thomas had the seats on one side, right?
Okay, yeah. I don't, man, you know what? We never played a game against them at that stadium in 3 years. They made us play it. It was a big deal to play it like Dyer or Del Mar Stadium in Houston. You're one of them, you know.
Oh, y'all actually got to play where the city kids play.
Yeah, right. Exactly. They had to, but you know what? They in recent years, they moved that game to Reliant, whatever they call a Reliant Stadium down. They played a neutral site because, you know, St. Thomas, I ain't going to say they ain't got no money, but they ain't got facilities like they got money.
Okay, I'm with you. Now, we bring you all around to the state of Texas, where Texas and Oklahoma looked at the Big 12 and was like, deuces, we out this piece. And then it makes you look around and realize that the Big 8 / Big 12 and / SWC has been like two good schools and bums since like the 1940s.
Hey, I mean, the bums comment, you know what I'm saying? That seems a little far. You know what
I mean,
saying?
Texas, to be fair, for SWC for a long time, Texas was one of the bums.
Okay, fair point.
Like, Texas is one of these schools that was really good until everybody got black people. And Texas, like, we don't need no black people. And they ain't never really quite recover from that dumb decision. You ever see that tweet that Stephen Godfrey sent when Texas was going through this whole Eyes of Texas thing and everything else? And he was like, I think it was Texas it was something to make the parallel between how Ole Miss looks at Alabama and wonders, why can't we be that? And Texas looks at Oklahoma and wonder, why can't we be that? And in both cases, they jumped on the wave.
Right. They were early adopters.
Yes.
They're living off that, you know, when their startup was banging, you know what I'm saying? Everybody else had gotten to the game. They were really excited. You know what I'm saying? Yes. They did really well. But now that everybody else is, you know, say, oh, we could get some of these brothers. You know what I'm saying? We can get them on down here. And, oh, now we can build these nice facilities too. Then All of a sudden, it ain't quite as sweet as it was for Texas.
SEC was an interesting evolution on integration because the big domino to drop on integration with Florida State and Miami, right? Like, they were the first ones to be like, nah, dog, we about to do it. Like, look around here. Look how many of them. Look how fast they are. Okay, we about to do it for real. And then that made everybody catch up. Like, you know, you get to the late 80s and early 90s, you still got white dudes playing receiver in the SEC.
Right. Well, actually, you know what one of the funniest facts of the SEC is that I just found out the other day? Do you know who the first black athlete in the SEC's history was?
Is it that dude that's a referee?
You're going to get it wrong, man. It was a baseball player for Tulane.
Really?
The guy named Stephen Martin. Yeah, 1966. I was like, oh, of course the guy that broke the color barrier in the SEC was in a school that ain't even in the league no more. You know what I'm saying? Oh, the next year, the next fall, then Kentucky got a couple of brothers.
Yeah, Wilbur and they were the guy I'm thinking about.
And Nate, I think Nate Northington or something like that.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, man, I mean, it's so weird. You talk about the evolution of the SEC and the idea that it is the most dominant conference in the country really is only about 15 years old.
Yes.
Take this trip with me. Did it start for you when 2004 Auburn
got left out of the national championship game?
When everybody started being like, yes, the SEC, how could you leave Auburn out? The SEC is so much tougher than everybody else.
Yes, not quite. The day exactly that it happened, that the whole perspective changed in people's minds, was the day that Oklahoma got their doors blown off by USC in the Orange Bowl that year. Because Auburn, to be fair, Auburn had three top 10 picks on the team, three first round picks on offense, one of whom was the quarterback.
Jason Campbell, Carnell Cadillac Williams, and Ronnie Brown.
Then Carlos Rogers at corner. Yep. Right. Mm-hmm, and so they had all those dudes. Now, granted, it was a Tuberville team, so he would have found a way to lose if they had actually gone out there and played USC. Because, I mean, that was during the run. I think USC went down to Auburn like the year before that or the year after and blew their doors off. Because USC was like, no, we going everywhere and we blowing everybody's doors off. After that, really, the SEC has been seen as the absolute dominant power. I think there have been years where the SEC has been overrated. I think the SEC is a bit more top heavy than people recognize. But around this time is the culmination of the money and also full integration of college football had really finally taken place in the SEC in a way that's different than everybody else. Because I was thinking about this the other day. I've been holding on this to tell you till we got on the air, but think about this. You know what's different between Alabama and, say, Ohio State? Ohio State still got white dudes in the front seven. Sometimes the white dudes be cold, right? Like, sometimes it's a Nick Bosa.
Sometimes they're Bosa family, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it's the Bosa. Sometimes it's A.J. Hawk. You know, like, them cats be. When is the last time there was a great white defensive player in the SEC?
Oh, my God.
Think about that, right? Like, in the Big 12, where you get, like, your Jordy Nelsons and your Jordan Shipleys and, like, you know, these random white dudes. Not random, because those are all, you know, especially Shipley. He was a big deal in high school. But, like, these white dudes that come out there and play. The SEC has given up on that whole idea.
Oh,
if you can't block or you can't throw, there is no room for you, Caucasian brother, in the Southeastern Conference.
I mean, man, I'm trying to run my head through all the SEC teams, and like, they ain't got an Andy Katsamoya nowhere.
You know
what I'm saying? I'm just like, man, is that not? Because you know he would be a folk hero.
Yes.
If they could gen one up, he would be, you know, celebrated. He would be the seven-figure dude that Bryce Young is about to be. You know what I'm saying?
The last good white defensive back in the SEC, I think I could remember it off the top of my head, 14 years ago. Interview with Vampire Dude from LSU, Stelts, who I was convinced. I think he was married as a senior, but I was like, oh, the world must have been yours at LSU, dog.
Oh, yeah. Man, that's a name I've not heard in a very long time.
Right.
Man, think about Florida didn't have one? Oh, my God. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, but think about that, though. Like, the SEC is like, no, we're not doing none of that. Like, we ain't doing nobody no favors. They can't see beyond it. They're like, what we have that nobody else has in the quantities that we have is local blacks. We have blacks all over the place, and we are going to put them on the field. They, but as you put it, you know they'd love to have a white dude be a star. So what? They ain't doing it.
Oh, man, like the Mississippi schools or whatever, if they could prop one of them dudes up, absolutely. But,
yep.
I mean, that's the thing. There was a study a few years ago, or maybe probably as a decade at this point, about how, like, how many 300-pound-plus defenders are in the southeast region of the country and, like, yeah, they're disproportionately overrepresented in the SEC's footprint. And I was like, oh, yeah, like, that's the difference, like, having those big defensive dudes that are also athletes. And that's just not what everybody else has. And, yeah, of course, if they come out of Mississippi, the blackest state in the nation, or, you know, Georgia, whatever, that's where all the black people are, you know what I'm saying, down south. So, yeah, man, they've got access.
And this is what Texas, Oklahoma walking into, right? My theory as to why Texas in particular is doing this is they were not going to ever be able to get good enough players again if they did not get out of the Big 12. But when Texas A&M went to the SEC West, this is what I thought was just, it wound up just messing everything up for everybody. Now, of course, A&M decided that they wanted to be good, and there's an institutional commitment to being good, and the recruiting has been good because they decided. Texas ain't got that same commitment to winning. They willing to blow it all over a damn song. You know what I'm saying? They don't care enough about trying to get them dubs. But once Texas A&M is in the SEC West, the best player in Texas might go to Alabama. The best player in Alabama will not go to Texas A&M, will not go to Texas, right? And so Ohio State started coming in because they're like, yeah, Big 12, you really trying to do that? Ohio State started coming in and getting all these dudes. And I think that Texas just looked around and realized running this conference is becoming a hindrance, and we're going to need to go get into another conference. But I don't know what kind of winning they're going to be able to do against these schools that really, really care about winning, right? Like, what was that dude? They let him wear the Tommy Nobis jersey to that one game. Brecken, whatever Brecken's last name was. It ain't Meyer because that's an actor. But you know what I'm talking about, that linebacker? What we just talked about? You ain't playing at Alabama. You ain't getting no burn at LSU. I can't even get on the field at any of those places, you know?
Absolutely. Man, look, Spencer wrote this piece in 2016 about, do you really want to know what it takes to beat Alabama? And this is like, you know, 2016. And at that point, they had like eight people listed as football analysts, you know, all this staff with former, you know, head coaches that were working as assistants. And like, there is a want to in the SEC that Texas does not have itself and has not actually run up against except in under embarrassing circumstances. I just can't imagine that. So we talked about this with Arkansas, Bomani. Like, okay, you've got a lot of money, but do your fans really care about how much money you make? You know what I mean? Like, your fans don't actually care about how much money you make and how nice your facilities are. They want you to win.
Right.
And what's the fun in making all this money and going 7-5 every year, 8-4? Because I think that's what Texas is set up to do, because that's kind of who they've been since desegregation. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's what they set up to do at first.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because one thing Texas hasn't been, though, is like consistently 5-7, consistently 4-8. This is going to make them step it up, because I think that being in the Big 12 did not make them step it up. This is going to make them step it up. And Oklahoma always got that want to. This is going to be a big win for them, because now they're like, oh, it's some more players that we're going to be able to get.
They can get some Tommy Harris's again. They can start getting more Tommy Harris's and things like
that. Right. Because their thing is weird, because people think about them as just getting, like, you know, all the best players in Texas. But annually, they really didn't win that many head-to-head battles in recruiting with Texas. That just wasn't it. But they were willing to make some different decisions and to go national and to get some guys and make it work. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they get guys out of California. They get guys out of Louisiana, Florida.
Exactly.
They've picked it up. Yeah, they didn't move off of Texas, but they were willing to look beyond Texas's borders much earlier than a lot of the other schools in their footprint. And that's how they were able to put it together.
And so now it's all, man. Like, all of this is about to happen. This whole thing is going to go down. Arkansas, by the way, I think is low-key an underrated winner in all of this.
Well, because they get some of the rivals again?
They get to play Texas again.
Yeah,
they don't really care about playing Oklahoma, but they will care about playing Oklahoma because it is a border game. But they really, really care about Texas. And Texas, for totally understandable and plausible reasons, has been like, why are we going to play you? We have absolutely nothing to gain. We don't want none of your players. You want all of ours. You guys care way more than we do. You know, like, they weren't going to do it. So Arkansas gets that part. They're going to have to reshuffle divisions. I don't know how exactly all that's going to wind up going, but let's talk about your boys in College Station. Is anything more pathetic in this world than telling people, we don't want Texas to come because we got an identity now?
Look, man. I know you like the big foot of the Aggies. They have to say that, right?
No.
Even if they don't believe it, they have to pretend that they want to put up a fight.
No. They have to put up a fight. But if your identity disappears because another Texas school is in your conference, you are saying that you don't have an identity, except that's not true. They absolutely have an identity, just not one that they want to claim in public.
Right. Well, it's kind of like in a different way, like SMU. It's like you pretended that you're something that you're not. You know what I'm saying? Because SMU doing all this. Are we the school of Dallas? And we, you know, they doing all this stuff, you know, representing for the city of Dallas. I'm like, bro, that's not who y'all are. And the same thing with Texas A&M. If you're not from Texas, you may get confused. You may not know what Texas A&M is, that it's the ag school. You know what I'm saying? And so, like, they're projecting something else. But, like, yeah, with Texas back in the league, then it becomes, oh, yeah, y'all are the cow school. And Texas is the flagship school of the state.
It's not the cow school part. It's that they how they are. They just different. Like,
you got a problem with the cadets, man?
I'm just saying it. For anybody who's been to College Station, actually, I do have a problem with the cadets. I'm with Mike Leach on that. Like, y'all ain't even know. Y'all pretending to be an army, right? But I don't know if we allowed to call things weird no more. You know what I'm saying? But, like, they different over there, man. Like, they whole steez. Will Muschamp even had jokes about College Station. Like, they want to be as weird as they want to be, and also want somebody to sign up to be weird, except they want black people to come play football and be in the midst of their weird. And that's a tough sell without, you know, some institutional commitment.
Yeah, well, I mean, but the thing is, I mean, they do have the institutional commitment. It's just, I mean, the thing is that we have to come to think of these football programs as distinctive from their institutions, because basically none of the football programs represent their institutions at the end of the day. Like, they're just for hire. Come on, man.
A&M, though. Hey, you know how you see how they get down at the games.
A&M,
and
but look, man, dog. Look, Bomani, we were growing up in the 90s. Again, I was confused as to how not black A&M was.
Yes.
Remember how A&M had brothers like Greg Hill? I mean, actually, one of the blackest people I've met in my life, I had to say it weird like this, Kyler Murray's daddy. Murray. One of the first black quarterbacks in the Southwest Conference. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
That was Jackie Sherrill A&M. Jackie Sherrill was operating according to a completely different paradigm.
Right. Jackie Sherrill A&M is the A&M I grew up with, though.
Right.
You know what
I'm
saying?
Right. That's what we got. We got the Sherrill into Slocum, which is still a lot of Jackie Sherrill A&M. And, you know, they kind of kept it rolling after a point. But I'm just saying, all things held equal, we have decades of evidence to indicate that if you ask a player if he wants to go to Texas or he wants to go to Texas A&M, he's going to go to Texas.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, Austin is a much different place than College Station.
Yeah. And look, let's be clear. It ain't like the University of Texas is some Shangri-La for the Afro-American, but it's not College Station.
Right. Well, I mean, look, man, we've talked about this before. Black people in Texas of a certain age feel a certain way and know something about Texas and its reputation that may not be quite as true today. It doesn't have quite the same reputation amongst black folks in Texas that it used to. Well, I mean, how could it, right?
I mean, the eyes of Texas brought that all back, though.
Well, yeah, that's you go. Yes.
That's the thing. Ole Miss, like, finally, someone we can judge. Someone we can look down our noses at.
Oh, imagine Lane Kiffin looking at Steve Sarkisian like, so y'all still tripping over that? For real? You know what I'm saying?
Lane Kiffin would have got that? The eyes of Texas out of there so fast. There's no way Lane Kiffin would have took that job if the eyes of Texas situation was what it was.
I mean, look, Bomani, aren't you not worried then that because of that, like, this fight over eyes of Texas, it's like it's showing us conflicting messages. It's like, how serious about winning are you if you're University of Texas? Because obviously you follow the money, but Texas money isn't a big deal. So tripping over something like that, like making a big deal out of that, to me, that just reveals like a confusion about whatever it is your priorities are supposed
exactly.
to be.
Look, I got some real decisions to make about if I'm gonna keep doing this. Like, just to be, it's becoming indefensible.
You should have been thinking about that a long time ago, but go ahead.
Yeah, but you and I have discussed this. Your people are from Texas, and my people are not from Texas. Mm-hmm. So I come into it like, oh, this is the place that I live now. This is, you know, this is the thing that I'm going to do. And I knew I wasn't going to do this Aggie thing because I saw who was doing that. And
well,
I didn't want to be
friends. It was right up
them.
The street from you. It was right up the
street
from you.
Yeah. I didn't want no parts of that. But now it's just kind of, I mean, because ain't none of these schools not got some legacy or some history Absolutely. To be ashamed of. But in 2021, most of them are trying to act like it's different. I talk about how Ole Miss could look down their nose at Texas. Now, granted, Mississippi is 36% black. I want to be clear about this as a state by percentage. But the last time I looked it up, Ole Miss was something like 18% black. Like, they put a lot of work. Considering what Ole Miss was, or what people think of Ole Miss, for them to get up to 18 requires a significant level of effort to get the people to come in there.
Absolutely.
Texas is like 5% black.
Right, right.
And the state is something like 12, but the Latino numbers are appalling, right? Like, no state public school has worked harder to stay white than the University of Texas has.
All of the big affirmative action battles of my life have taken place in Texas. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, the idea that black people and brown people have some sort of stake in the public institution in Texas, like, it's always been at stake. It's always been a subject of debate. And yeah, it's never felt very welcoming to black and brown people around the state or even outside of that. And so, yeah, I mean, Texas has always had to sort of deal with that, but it seems like they're regressing. And I don't know if that's just because of the political climate right now, like, maybe the political climate is what has made people sort of regress in that way, but it doesn't bode well if you want to compete. Like, if you just want to be University of Texas and kind of run your little footprint in this part of the country, then great. But if you want to project something else and to attract the sort of people and athletes that you want, then you might have to do something different than force people to stand up there and sing that damn choo-choo song.
They're going to have to figure something out and fast, because look, for the last 10 years, they've been mediocre. Mm-hmm. They could walk into this SEC and be embarrassing, which, by the way, would be a big difference from when the other two Big 12 schools went into the SEC. Because those schools, like A&M, is now getting back up to maybe being as good as they were that first year where they just had all those first round picks all over the place. Mm-hmm. Missouri went to the SEC championship game twice because they could recruit better players in the Big 10 than they could recruit in the SEC. Like, Missouri, I think, is another winner in this, whether they realize it or not, because now they can go back to recruiting in Texas, right? Like, they can go back to maybe getting some of those players. But Texas is going to come out there and get embarrassed if they don't step it up really, really fast. And we're going to find out if they actually care about winning or if they'd rather just antagonize non-white people.
I mean, that's a hell of a way to say it. I mean, and here's the thing, man. Like, I don't think that ultimately that this antagonism towards black folk is going to prevail. Like, I think that they're going to get to the SEC. And I don't think Texas may never be great or as great as it is in its fans' imagination, but it doesn't have to be bad. Right. You know, like, Texas can always mean something and be like a 9-10 win program. Even in down years, they can do that. But I guess the issue is, like, how in terms of your brand, like, being a big brand in the game is great, but are you going to be able to finally get everything aligned? Like, that's the one thing about A&M and Alabama and Florida and some of these other schools is that they've been able to get everybody aligned. Like, everybody's going pointing in one direction. Texas has never been able to do that, right? They've never been able to get everybody on the same page. And I think that's sort of telling. That's how you end up with Steve Sarkisian as your coach, right? If you were as good as you thought you were, if everything was in place like you thought it should be, then you would get somebody better than Steve Sarkisian as your head coach. No offense to him, but, like, nobody was looking at that. Like, anybody that a year ago, if you pointed them and say, well, they're going to replace Tom Herman with Steve Sarkisian, somebody would have been like, what happened? What went wrong there?
Right.
So I don't know, man. I know Texas as a 7-8 win program, a team that's won only 3 Big 12 titles in the last 25 years.
The 2005 national championship team is one of the 10 greatest teams in the history of college football, despite everything you just said.
I'm glad you got that, but is you happy?
I just wanted to point that out as you were talking about.
Is you happy, Bumani?
I'm just talking about it. As a Texas you talk fan. About what you know. I mean, of course I'm not. They doing that choo-choo nonsense. No, I'm not happy.
But wipe that out of the screen. Are you happy with the state?
Obviously, I'm not. We lose to schools like, well, not we, but you know what I mean. Texas loses to schools like TCU. Of course, there's no reason to be happy there. Now, I'm going to just make this point, and this is what should scare everybody, right? A&M is riding higher than they ever have. They went 9-1 last year. They feel great about themselves. I think that team was a little overrated, but whatever, right? Like, they feel good about themselves. They lost to Alabama by 4 touchdowns, right? Like, A&M, which we would say is definitely at a better place right now than Texas is, and they still 28 points behind Alabama. That's like, this is what you're walking into if you expect to be competitive. And look, Texas has only won like any conference championship since Daryl Royal quit, like something like 7 times. Like, they weren't even winning the SWC.
In our lifetime, they've won 7 conference championships. 7.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And one of them was that 96 team that went 8-5 and beat Nebraska on a fluke game, right?
Yeah, and that team was loaded, by the way. Right. They just underachieved until all of a sudden they overachieved.
The team that had Priest Holmes as basically like just kind of a throw-in backup? You know what I mean? Like
Priest Holmes. Yeah. Priest Holmes and Ricky Williams. I mean, yeah, Priest Holmes and Ricky Williams on the same team and you went 8-5.
Right, right.
You went 8-5.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. So, I mean, again, I mean, Texas has never quite been everything that everybody says it is. The thing is though, Bomani, like, nobody's going to beat Alabama. You know what I mean? Like, no, like Alabama is going to be what it is for the most part for the next few years. But I guess that's the thing that maybe you're putting hope in and the University of Texas is hoping. And maybe Oklahoma, too. They're just like, Nick Saban can't coach forever. And maybe we can get ourselves to a program.
Oklahoma, like, you can't leave us here alone. Like, we're going to wrap this up soon. But the big thing about it was, if Texas leaves, all the good real estate, like there's no good real estate left for the Big 12. It has awful real estate generally. Everybody's had to eat off of the state of Texas, or you had to be Oklahoma and be able to recruit nationally, or Kansas State and be willing to recruit nationally while also having this bizarre, we tell kids to go to junior college and then trot out a team full of 26 and 27 year olds, you know, to go win. Because how else are you supposed to win football games at Kansas State? The whole thing, I don't want to say the whole like mechanism and everything around college football is falling apart. Everything's about to change in a big way, because the big problem those Big 12 schools have, other than Kansas, don't nobody want none of y'all, and nobody really wants Kansas. They'd like to have your basketball program, but they don't want your school, and they damn sure don't want your football. Like, nobody else has anything that anybody wants.
I mean, no, you said nobody wants – I mean, you said Kansas. Man, absolutely nobody wants Kansas. You got the worst Power 5 program, football program in the country, scandal-plagued basketball program. Yeah, nobody wants them.
And no people in your state.
And no people in your state, right. Yeah, because this isn't like a thing where you – like with Missouri or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, this Kansas is basically your base. But I guess my thing is that why would anybody want any of these other schools? And I mean, I'm putting TCU in that, because we know that like TV market isn't quite the same thing. Like we don't judge it off cable hookups anymore, cable households. You know what I mean? Like, that's not the standard that people use anymore. So even the argument that you could say, well, to the Pac-12 or whatever, oh, well, you could come get Texas Tech, TCU, Oklahoma State. That's not a footprint that you've had before. But people know better than that now than they knew 10 years ago. They're like, oh.
Ain't nobody watch them. Just because they in a state don't mean nobody watch them, right?
Well, it's like Houston. It's like Houston, right? Like, nobody, Houston is in the Houston market, but nobody's watching University of Houston sports.
No, at a different point, maybe, right? But now, not so much. But hey, man, we just gonna see, I suppose. That is Joel Anderson, who is not the fastest 42-year-old in America, but he was once the fastest 10-year-old in America.
I think I'm probably in the top 10% of the fastest 42-year-olds in the country, though. I'll put myself there. I give myself that. I got on compression shorts now, bro. You know what I'm saying? I go out and run. I go run. Nah, I'm not running. I'm not going to do nothing like that.
That's Joel Anderson. Check him out. Slate.com. Doing all kinds of wonderful work. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this three times a week. Gabe Bassain and Dave Presley handling things behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.